Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. Time for KER Politics, although this particular segment is about as far away from politics as you can get. We're kind of getting away from politics, I have to tell you. That is very much of a no-win situation. I had a woman on the program last week who I was very, very impressed with. She was involved in human resources. The vice president and president of the company, one of the leaders of the company, is on the show with me this week. His name is Bill Lyons. Bill is about as far away from me as he can get, as he said. He's down in Alabama. That's football country, in my opinion. And Big Al is a big, big Alabama fan, no question about that, Bill. You guys got a great.
That's good to know.
You guys got a great team. Got a couple of questions. I was very impressed with the lady who I spoke with last week about your concept of employees. Employees are really, when you look at Lion Management, they look at employees as one very, very valuable asset of a company. Tell us a little bit, Bill, about why that's how you look at them, and that is the philosophy that you have, sir.
Well, in my experience, companies are successful or not successful based upon how effective their hiring practices are and how effective their people are and how productive they are.
Right.
I mean, most problems center around people when you talk about organizations, and of course, companies are organizations. And so our approach to that is treating employees as the most valuable asset within an organization. Of course, you know, labor cost is something that has to be considered in any business.
You bet.
It's a line item on the P&L, and of course people have to look at it. But if you look at your employees as an investment and as the most important asset, not like an asset on a balance sheet, obviously it's something that does require us to have a strategic approach to it. You know, human resources has become a much more complicated discipline over the last 40 years. I mean, gone are the days where you had a personnel department that did hiring and firing and kept up with employee records. It's become a legal matter. It has become a matter of, you know, health insurance has become such a complicated part of the entire mix. Safety environment. Of course, in a post-COVID world, everyone is rewriting safety protocols to make certain we're all complying with public mandates. And you know, safety has always been a top concern. But in the post-COVID world, as companies are bringing employees back in, the number one responsibility is making certain that they're all safe. And so we've had to stay current on what our states and federal governments are requiring us to do with our clients while they're bringing their people back to work.
You know, I have to say it's evolved into actually a pretty complicated area, and it's an area where there is a real need for experts. There's no question about that. Bill, I ran my own company for 40 years. And I have to tell you, I learned very quickly that you are nowhere near as effective as your employees. That's the wrong way to put it, I guess. I considered employees of mine for that 40-year period to be an incredibly valuable asset. Employees will make or break a company. Any comments on that, sir?
I think that's absolutely spot on. You know, we believe that effective companies are companies that really focus and make a priority out of their culture. You know, culture is what dictates behavior when no one is looking or when no one is paying attention to what you're doing, and that starts at the top. So
yeah.
good business owners and executives will start a culture of a healthy culture, and it will just permeate throughout the organization. And that's what drives successful companies. It starts with, you know, a strong mission, a business that is forward-thinking and lays out what they're trying to accomplish and what they want to be. It is followed by effective team building, getting the right skill sets in the right positions. And then right after that, to me, the most important thing that a business owner or CEO can do is be the biggest cheerleader for his company as he can be or she can be, and that is by driving culture, a culture where everyone is thrives, a culture where everyone can participate and where everyone can reach their full potential.
And that culture really has evolved into something, I would have to say, much more integrate than it was, you know, when I was a kid, for example. Bill, I got a question for you. We're still in the middle of COVID up here. I mean, all over the world, pretty much. How has that changed your method of consulting, I guess is the best way to put it?
Well, I'm a little old-fashioned in that I like to deal with people face-to-face, and
right.
obviously that's been disrupted. And never before have we seen such a speedy adaptation of technology. I think that that's one thing that we that's obviously here to stay. You know, the Zoom meetings and the Teams meetings and the various technology tools that we now have to stay in touch with our customers and with our employees, particularly if you have multiple locations. I think that that's been expedited probably by at least 5 years over the last 1 year. People that never used those tools before are now employing them on a regular basis, and we're one of them. But as I said before, I think safety, workplace safety, you've seen workflows that have had to be redesigned and reconfigured just to provide for the distancing that's necessary. Obviously, when you go into to large retail stores or restaurants, you see very obvious signs of adaptation that's had to take place. And of course, we've had to help our clients with this. Number one priority these days is keeping people safe. It's always been a top priority, but never has it been more important than it is right now.
You know, I find that very, very easy to believe. I want to say one other thing. One thing that I found running my business, Mr. Lyons, is the fact that an employee is your best friend, your most important associate, for lack of better terms. And it's critical that you're not acting when you try to put that across. It's critical that employees realize that, no matter how far up the ladder they are. Don't you agree?
I think that is very, very important that employees understand their role. They understand the importance they play. And that goes back to the vision that I mentioned to begin with. The most important thing that a CEO can do is, when he sets that vision, is help communicate it throughout the organization so employees understand their role, they understand their company's role within the larger industry, and that sense of purpose is a critically important part of building a healthy culture.
I think employees have to understand that they are, no matter how far up the ladder they are or how far down the ladder they are absolutely critical to a successful organization. And I think one of the most important things that management can accomplish is bringing that particular philosophy front and center, regardless of the company.
That's true. It has to be communicated on a regular basis. If what you're talking about, and again, I think we're talking about company culture and what you have to do to build it, it has to be something that's purposeful. It has to be something that is a priority. If it's a slogan that only a few people know and it's not communicated throughout the company, it will not be very effective. But if it's something that is shown by example, by leadership within the organization, and it's something that people can get on board with, these are the things that make companies very, very successful. It certainly goes beyond compensation and benefits, although those are very important. In our business, we talk about the importance of attracting and retaining the right people. Mm-hmm. Well, you have to have a competitive compensation and benefits plan to attract those employees, but retaining them is a different matter altogether, and that's where the culture comes into play. You know, when an employee or a candidate for a job is interviewing, they very rarely will ask about the culture of the company, and that is probably the most important determinant as to whether they will be satisfied in that job. Is, you know, what's the company culture? Do I enjoy working with the people? Do I dread going to work every day? The thing that I think about all the time in my role is, what can I do to make this a better company to work for? I believe in paying people as much as you can pay them, and then getting out of their way and letting them do their jobs, and then supporting them in every way that you can, but also holding them accountable.
I got to tell you, Mr. Robbins, that's exactly the way I felt when I was running my company. And I have to say that I'm thoroughly enjoying this conversation, as I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation with one of your associates last week, because you guys really bring home in spades the importance of treating your employees like family. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions for Bill Lyons, please communicate with him through our blog.
Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in, time for the second segment of the KE Report. Chatting right now with Mark Williams, a very sophisticated financial planner, been around for a lot of years. Advice for people like Mr. Williams is critical during these turbulent times in the economy. Mark, if I'm not mistaken, you specialize primarily in retirement savings.
That's correct. Insurance and retirement, correct.
Tell us a little bit about your qualifications, if you would, sir.
I'm president and CEO of a company called Brokers International out of Des Moines, Iowa. I've been in the financial services business my entire career, about 32 years.
Wow.
Mainly on the insurance and investing side. I have worked with three major insurance carriers, and I have been the president of two major insurance distribution companies. Currently at Brokers International, we assist over 4,500 independent financial planners, registered reps, insurance agents throughout the country. We distribute insurance products through over 50 different carrier relationships. We also own a broker-dealer and an RIA. And through that broker-dealer and RIA, we service about 200 registered reps and asset managers.
Mark, I am very concerned right now about retirement savings simply because I'm very aware of the fact, having been in this business for over 40 years, I'm very aware of the fact that Social Security pretty much in jeopardy, in my opinion. Very quickly, could you elaborate on that?
If you look at the history of Social Security and the population, Social Security was created. We had, for every one person receiving Social Security, you had three people working and paying into the system. Now you almost have the exact reverse. For every three people receiving benefits, you have one worker contributing. Now, you and I both know that's a recipe for disaster over the long haul. Either we're going to have to raise taxes or raise the amount going into the system from the small amount of workers there are to recipients, or you're going to have to reduce the benefit or possibly a mixture in between. As well, we're looking at increasing the age in which you would be eligible for that benefit. So that whole recipe isn't a positive one. Which, back to your earlier comments, those people that have savings, especially during the COVID times, that may find themselves out of work or furloughed, are now starting to dip into those savings.
Yep.
So if you were fortunate enough to have your own savings, now you're looking at the possibility of less benefits from the government, using some of the benefits you've saved for. And that's a recipe for disaster, quite frankly. And I think the majority of the population really needs to sit down with someone and talk about their options.
On a personal note, I agree with you 1,000%. And the reason I do is that having a substantial background in economics and finance, I realized back in the 80s and 90s that our economy, with the level of debt that we have and our Social Security system, which was great when it started, but it is really in a precarious situation right now. Listeners need to be aware of the fragility of the longevity, I guess is the word that I would use, sir, of the Social Security system. I think people who count simply on that are making a big mistake.
I 100% agree with you. And add into that the advancements in technology that we've made in medicine, which are incredibly positive, but we're actually extending the amount of time that people live and live quite healthily and productive. Think about that old adage of I'm going to retire at 55 or 60. I think the new normal is going to be living longer means working longer. It's more benefits that you need and or more of your own personal savings you need to live on. You also mentioned the debt. So when you add demographics and the advancements in medicine and longevity, and we have all of these other issues, the debt that we have, lack of benefits, the onus really does fall on the individual to really start thinking about how they plan for their future.
Mr. Williams, tell us a little bit about the products and services that you offer, not necessarily in the insurance industry, but primarily in the financial planning industry.
Sure. So one of the great advantages in the financial planning world is the ability for the average person to have access to what I would consider top-tier money management. if you went back 20 or 25 years, in order to have an asset manager manage your money, you needed to open accounts with $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000.
Mm-hmm.
Today, that's not true. In fact, today, the amount of information you have and the access for the average consumer to be able to open an account with $10,000 or $15,000 and have access to the same money managers that many, many much more wealthy people have is a huge advantage. So one of these services that we offer is access to what we call TAMPs, or Turnkey Asset Management Programs. And there are literally thousands of financial planners nationwide that your listeners can reach out to and get advice on who could manage your money. And you really do have access to professional money managers. So that's the first section of what we do, is match someone's needs with the type of money management that we believe that could be beneficial to them. The second thing, and then the other thing that we offer, of course, through a broker dealer is access to stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs. One of my recommendations always is for someone to seek out professional advice. So again, we work with literally thousands of financial planners nationwide that we can offer referrals to. We can offer a client or a customer the way to research those financial planners to make sure that they are suitable and that they fit those needs of that consumer. And we can give them a sneak peek into their background, and then provide a platform to not only take a look at what their needs are, but also provide hundreds and hundreds of solutions that the general public might not know about. So those are some of the services that we offer to the public.
You know, I think it's very important for people to go to an expert when they are looking to enhance their own personal financial security. No question about that. Real quick, sir, how does your insurance products, how do they fit in?
So, and I'm glad you asked. So, first of all, life insurance. If anyone relies on someone else for income, the number one question we ask is, God forbid they don't make it home, how do you replace that income?
Right.
And that's really with life insurance. And life insurance should be purchased younger, because generally speaking, the younger you are, the healthier you are. So that's the first thing I'd look at. And the second thing is the new generation of annuities. Annuities can be a nice platform, because what an annuity provides in its basic form is the ability to receive an income stream that a customer can't outlive. And in fact, not only can they not outlive it, you can designate money to be paid to a spouse or a significant other once you have passed. And that steady stream of income is not affected by interest rates or the stock market in many cases, and there are literally hundreds of types of annuities. So those two products specifically are somewhat of the foundation of many financial plans for a lot of the public.
Mark, I want to make one comment. Number one, we're out of time here for the radio portion. Record a second segment for you. We will air it as a weekend special. Take about another maybe 3, 4, 5 minutes. Can you do that?
You bet, sure.
I want to carry Mark Williams over into a weekend special. The reason I'm doing that is because I believe that we are really in uncharted waters right now. You need to be financially secure, because that way you can weather all the storms that the political turmoil is going to cause us and has already caused us. Listen to what he has to say in the special.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in, time for the second half of KER Politics. I'm going to talk about what's going on in the country right now with the change of the inhabitant of the executive branch. Got Jim McKinney on the line with me, and one of our neighbors who is very politically astute, by the same token, has some serious questions he wants to ask Jim. I asked him to come on the program, and the reason I did is because my buddy's questions are very typical of what's going on in society right now. Mr. Neighbor, Al, you want to ask the first question to Jim McKinney?
Sure. Yeah, I've been obviously very disappointed in the outcome of the election, and especially the Georgia runoff. I didn't think that was handled very well. But, you know, going forward, I'd be interested in what conservatives could do heading up to the 2022 election, because I think it's mandatory that we take back the House and hopefully the Senate. So I'd just be interested, Jim, in where you think things are going to be going, and what we can do to facilitate the conservatives getting back into some position of power.
Well, I think that's a great question, and there's a tremendous amount of frustration out there with what happened. And, you know, taking away, if you just stop and you know, the evidence of problems with the election, and you forget about that, and don't think about the presidential race, but consider the House races, consider the state legislative races and the governor's races. The Republican Party did exceptionally well this last, in November. So there's optimism out there for conservative views and values. What you don't have is confidence in our system, and that's the most important thing that has to happen, in my view, is we have to rebuild confidence in our system. And what that means is the Republican legislatures in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Arizona, they need to hold people accountable to their own state laws on how to manage the elections. And they cannot allow this continued COVID and the mail-in ballots that basically have created such distrust in the system. That's the first step. The second step is to quit kowtowing to the left. In my view, the people in Washington, D.C., especially a lot of the Republicans that have been around for a long time, they live in a world where they are friends and have drinks after work with their Democratic partners. And we want, you know, some relationship, of course, always positive relationship. But what's happening is they're being suckered by their Democratic leaders, because the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate, they do not care about the American people. From my perspective, they care about power, and you have to go into this understanding that's their objective. And what I see is a Republican Party that's going to be quite frustrated, that's going to have some realignment time right now back to those basic principles that Trump represented. And that's, you know, he wanted to give manufacturing back. He wanted to give people, the minorities, he wanted to give the average working class a future and give America strength. And what we've seen from the Democrats is, hey, you know what? We're going to succumb to the powers of corporate corruption. We're going to let the tech gurus shut us down. And they've got to stop that. They've got to not allow that to happen. And that's the big fight right now.
Jimmy, I got to tell you, I'm not quite sure how we can accomplish that right now. And the reason I say that is America right now is in an incredible state of turmoil. I was awoken this morning to the news in the Seattle Times that the distribution of the COVID medication is simply too disorganized right now. Actually, the reporter who wrote this particular article waited in a line which was 1 mile long in Squim, Washington, to get the inoculation, and when he was roughly five people away, they announced they couldn't do it anymore because they had run out. When, number one, we need some disorganization. And if people don't understand that the liberal administration is totally screwing up the COVID vaccination distribution, which I just described how that's happening in Washington State, if they don't understand that, they won't understand anything. So you have to, I believe, keep tabs on the success of the tasks that are being undertaken by the liberals right now. So far, we've had no luck whatsoever. Jimmy, comments?
Well, the reason why we've got no luck is because the media, the tech giants, have suppressed any knowledge that undermines the narrative that there's mistakes in New York, that there's mistakes in Washington State or California. They're taking away actual dialogue. They're taking away the ability to discourse or complain or even, you know, question the narrative. And I think that's an important thing that has to happen. And I did the radio show for our local radio station this morning. I do my weekly show on foreign affairs, and I talked about foreign governments, our allies, that are actually very frustrated, not big fans of Donald Trump, but are very frustrated with the tech companies clamping down on democratic free speech.
Yep.
And that's where we've got to get the democratic powerful influencers to say, you know what, this can go both ways. So you better step up to the plate right now and start control, you know, stopping this control of information. And that's going to be the biggest challenge in my view, because really it's about the propaganda. That's where what's shaping everyone's vision. That's what's scaring people. And as we get more and more information on what happened on January 6th, we're realizing that maybe the narrative that came out of the media immediately was false. A lot of the information that was suppressed about the elections is completely being suppressed. We've got to change that. And that's your point is good. If people don't understand it and we can't debate it, we can't dialogue about it, then we will not know. And that's going to be problematic.
We have an almost insurmountable problem at this point. Al, I want to ask you, we've got about 2 minutes left here. Jim understands the clock. You got another question, sir?
Do I have another question? Yeah, well, yeah, following up to Jim's most recent comment about, you say that the big tech and the suppression and all, that's our big challenge. How do we go about, crafting debate and moving away from big tech's control? How do you do that?
Yeah, it's
minutes,
a tough
Jimmy.
One.
Jimmy, 2 minutes.
Yeah. So the first is the Section 230 in the Federal Communications Act that allows them basically, I look at it like this. They produce the paper that the newspaper prints the information on. They're controlling what the newspapers print on the paper. That's what the platforms are doing right now. That can't last. They can't tell and control what people are saying, what are being done. So we've got to figure out how our legislators can reach out and stop that type of control. The second piece of it is there is enough information out there. You just have to go to alternative sources, and you have to be able to present that a little bit better. It's tough in a monopolistic system, but that's where we've got to go. And, you know, of course, as they try to clamp down, you're going to have to use anti-monopoly rules with what happened with Amazon closing out Parler, and then Google and Apple closing out their ability to actually download the apps. That has got to change. And it's not that hard to do, but they have to get consensus. We have to push our legislators to do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got about 25 seconds left here. I'm going to have to take a real quick commercial break. Pardon me, Big Al's going to be back in a flash. Frog in my throat. Don't open your mouth, Corlin. Anyhow, going to have to take a real quick commercial break, just probably a few seconds, just a few, very few, 1 or 2 minutes, and I'm going to be right back with our friend from Semiamu and Jim McKinney. Stick around. Welcome in here to wrap up KER. This is a political issue. It's called homelessness. I have a gentleman who is the co-author of a book. Man's name is Wayne Weingarten. He lives in Southern California. We were talking off mic a little bit at the problem there as compared to the problem, let's say, in Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and now Bellingham, Washington. It's a very interesting situation. The problems are all pretty similar. Wayne, I don't want to do too much talking, but I want to say one thing. We live in an area about, 2 hours north of Seattle where the homelessness is amazingly bad. I was working out down at our athletic club one day, and I just happened to be sitting in the sauna with the chief prosecutor, city mayor, actually, of Seattle, Washington. And this was about a year ago. And I mentioned to him, I said, you've got one hell of a homeless problem down there. And I said, I'd like to, if you don't mind, could you just tell me in summary what you guys can do about it? And the fellow who is the in charge of the legal department for Seattle, Washington, was at the time, looked at me and he said, it is not solvable, period, in Seattle. That really made me stop and think. Mr. Weingarten, would you agree with that? It has morphed into a problem that really isn't solvable anymore.
Well, there's an aspect that's not solvable in the sense that current legal rulings in the Ninth Circuit, which covers Oregon, Washington, California, is making it very difficult to solve it, because that ruling is creating a right to live on the street. And with that right to live on the street, it makes it very difficult to solve the problem. And then when you throw in the issues, which applies in Seattle just as much as it does in California, issues of housing affordability and housing shortages. When you put in the approach to drugs, where there's an openness for the drug use on the streets, all of these things compound and make it very difficult. So that is a tremendous problem. And this is one of the topics we cover in the book, and one of the more important issues is we need to get a better balance in that legal environment in order to solve the problem. This growing right to live on the street, where that comes from is a case from Boise, Idaho, where the ruling was, if I am homeless, right, then I'll have no place to sleep. But sleep is an essential function of being human. It's something we all need to do. So if I have no home and you cannot guarantee that there's a safe bed for me to go to, then in fact you can't deny me a basic human function, a basic human right of sleeping. And from that is developing this de facto right to live on the street. And so that I think is part of the problem, and obviously I don't know for sure, but I think that might be part of what he's referring to. Policies are bad all over, but policies can be changed. But when you have this growing right it's constitutional, that makes things incredibly difficult to solve. But I am an optimist, and I think we can get there. I think we can do better on programs and how we serve the poor. I think we can address the affordability issues. And so I think through those things, we can start to make a difference. And then we need to start getting that legal clarity so that we can enforce vagrancy rights. Because, and this was part of our approach, the idea that allowing people to sleep on the streets is not the humane way to deal with the problem. It's ignoring it, but it's not helping the people. It's creating problems for the community, and it's creating very large economic losses for the business community. So it's an all-around lose-lose situation. And so what we wanted to do was evaluate the causes of it and then come up with some suggested reforms that can help get us over that problem.
Mr. Weingarten, at this point, do you have any suggestions to solve this? I have to tell you, I am a real bleeding heart in the sense that I am a conservative, but I feel terribly sorry for people who are thrown in the position where they are homeless. I really don't know what to do about it. I know that here in Bellingham, Washington, the homeless problem has gotten so badly that it has now moved actually into what I would call the some of the exclusive areas, and you're very right. The courts can do nothing about that other than watch real estate values go down to nothing. There has to be a solution to a problem like this, at least in my opinion. Just off the cuff, do you have any thoughts about it, Wayne?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we suggest, just programmatically, is relying on more of these very innovative nonprofits as opposed to the government. They're outsourcing a lot of the service to these nonprofits. There's a lot of very innovative programs. One that we highlight in the book, it's an organization called Shelters to Shutters. And they're focusing more on the situational homeless rather than those who suffer with mental illness or substance abuse. But if you're situationally homeless, particularly along the West Coast, housing affordability is so unaffordable that a lot of people, or too many people, I should say, are one adverse life event away, or unemployment, whatever the case, from cycling down into homelessness. And so for those people, what Shelters to Shutters would do is it would say, okay, we need to treat this holistically. It's not about getting somebody necessarily just into a home. It's helping them have the skills necessary in a job so that they can be sustainable and actually kind of get things going again and begin to kind of live, build wealth, you know, and rejoin kind of that community. So programs like Shelters to Shutters that actually looks at things holistically is a much more effective way of actually addressing the problem. Another solution, which actually works within this growing right to live on the street, because remember, a lot of that depends upon whether or not there's a bed available. And so using law enforcement as a resource so that you can actually connect, they interact with the homeless community often, they can connect those individuals to shelters that are available, so that if we have more innovation in terms of the types of shelters and expanding that resource, you can get people off of the street even within this very strict interpretation, because the law enforcement would actually be aware that there are beds available. So, you know, better leveraging law enforcement. And there's programs, the HOST program, that have been out there that have done that very well. You also have to get at some of the root causes of the problem. So looking at affordability, we need to change our zoning regulations. We need to change our environmental regulations to bring down the cost of housing. In California, when you're talking about it takes 50, 60, 70% of your gross income for the average person to afford the average home in California, it's, you know, these are just ridiculous levels. Traditionally, you talk about 30% of your income should be going towards housing. So when you're at these levels, it's just not sustainable. And so you're going to constantly be pushing people to the edge. That has to be addressed. So we have to change our zoning regulations so that we can get the supply of housing up. You know, part of the problem is just it's basic econ 101,
yeah,
where you have a shortage of homes and the excess of demand. That really isn't rocket science. It's just you need more homes. And then we need to get innovative with how we help people who are suffering with mental illness.
Wayne, I need to stop you for a second. Please. We're on a clock, unfortunately. I've got very little time left here, but I'm going to tell you what I want to do. I am very, very knowledgeable, I have to say, not to the extent that you are, but certainly to the extent of the average person. I'm pretty knowledgeable on this subject. What I'm going to do is I am going to give all kinds as much visibility as I can on your book. When I say as much visibility, I mean as much visibility as I can, other than just a conversation. And what I would like very much to do is I would like to have you back on the program, if you wouldn't mind, have it next week. I'd like to continue this discussion. We're kind of out of time right now, but all the visibility that I can, sir, I will give to your book. This is one of the largest problems, in my opinion, that we have in the U.S.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.